This is Pittsburgh Explainer, a new podcast from 90.5 WESA. We bring you the biggest news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania every Friday. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed.
I'm Anlie Herring. I cover the justice system and county government.
I'm Kathleen Davis. I cover a variety of topics, including air quality and sustainability.
I'm Margaret J. Krause. I cover development, transportation, and infrastructure.
It's Friday, February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. Today, why has the U.S. Attorney's Office in Western Pennsylvania become the clearinghouse for the information Rudy Giuliani supposedly has on the Biden family in Ukraine? And the Allegheny County Health Department is hailing a recent settlement with U.S. Steel as a victory for Mon Valley communities, but environmental groups are skeptical. Finally, the city of Pittsburgh takes steps to make its aging municipal buildings more energy efficient. We'll dig into these stories right after the break.
On Saturday, February 22nd, the Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting Community Food Connections Initiative will be hosting a check-in for the 16th annual Southside Soup Contest at 67 Bedford Square, the home of WYEP and WESA. Bring a non-perishable food item to the station for the Brashear Association Food Pantry and check in for the contest from 11:30 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. The contest benefits the Brashear Association and Southside Chamber of Commerce. For more information, visit WYEP.org/food.
This is Pittsburgh Explainer. I'm Liz Reed. We'll start this week with government and accountability reporter Anlie Herring. Anlie, can you start just by setting the scene a little bit for us? What kind of information is the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, supposedly feeding to the Justice Department?
Giuliani says he has material that's related to the Biden family's activity in Ukraine. You might recall that Trump accused Joe Biden of using his influence when he was vice president to help the Ukrainian energy company Burisma when Biden's son Hunter served on the company's board. And Giuliani says Ukrainian sources have supplied him with relevant information. Attorney General William Barr says his department is going to evaluate that material. And this all comes after Trump was impeached on accusations that he pressured Ukraine to investigate Biden. Of course, the Senate acquitted the president last week, and now it appears Barr is having U.S. prosecutors in Pittsburgh look into the matter. It's not clear why the Pittsburgh office was chosen to review this information from Giuliani. Some say that it's because the office has experience prosecuting Russians for cybercrimes.
Why is this arrangement raising concerns?
It's unusual for the Department of Justice to ship this type of work out to a local U.S. attorney's office, in any other administration, that is. Since Trump became president, the department has done this in a couple of other politically charged cases, so this does seem to be a pattern with them. And that makes some worry that Attorney General Barr is using career prosecutors to do campaign work for the president.
This comes after revelations that the Justice Department recommended a lighter sentence for Trump ally Roger Stone than four career prosecutors on the case had originally suggested, right? So some people are accusing Trump of having politicized the Department of Justice for his own ends.
That has raised serious concerns. And before that, Barr had drawn scrutiny for delaying the release of the Mueller report and just making some other decisions that tended to favor Trump's allies and hurt his enemies. But all of that actually led St. Vincent professor Bruce Yankoviak, who I spoke with earlier this week and who once served as a federal prosecutor in Western Pennsylvania, to say that it makes sense for the main Department of Justice office in D.C. to send this work to a U.S. attorney's office outside of the Capitol. He says that this could at least help to create an appearance of independence between prosecutors reviewing the files that Giuliani says he has and Trump's associates in such a fraught political environment.
It is about as acrimonious as you could imagine a political system being without ripping apart. It perhaps is not surprising that efforts are being made where the subject matter would be the investigation of the potential criminal activity of a clear political rival to make sure that there is an assurance as much as can be possibly made to the public that an assessment is going to be made of that information dispassionately and without considerations as to how it might affect the political tides that are coming in the future.
The U.S. Attorney's Office here in Western Pennsylvania is led by Scott Brady. What do we know about him? What kind of prosecutor is he?
I asked Jankowiak about this, as well as former U.S. Attorney Harry Littman, who led the Pittsburgh office in the late 90s. They said they have no reason to believe that Brady would politicize the work of his office. Of course, having been appointed by Trump, they noted he is considered a reliable conservative. But otherwise, we don't know of any reason to think that this review of this material from Rudy Giuliani would be done in any way that is not independent from political interests or influences.
Kathleen, you've been following the settlement that the county health department recently finalized with U.S. Steel. How long has this settlement been in the works and what does it stem from?
This settlement is related to multiple pollution violations at Clairton Coke Works from June 2018 to May 2019. It's important to note that the settlement is not related to the Christmas 2018 fire that knocked out some pollution controls at Clairton Coke Works. These are separate violations. Each of them led to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fines for U.S. Steel. So a draft of this agreement was released last summer. There was a 30-day public review. There was a public hearing about this. And so we have known about at least some of the details of this agreement for about half a year now.
What does the agreement require?
The big things that this agreement requires is increased reporting by U.S. Steel of emissions violations, an annual performance audit, equipment upgrades worth $200 million, and also for U.S. Steel to pay out these fines that are worth $2.7 million. Two things that there weren't details on: this community benefits trust that is being put together. So of the $2.7 million worth of fines, 90% of those will go into this trust, and then the trust money will be distributed to communities that are around the Clairton Coke Works. So Clairton, Glassport, Lincoln, Liberty, and Portview. There will also be a community advisory panel formed, and that panel will meet regularly with representatives from U.S. Steel and will include one government representative and one resident representative each from those communities.
$2.7 million in fines for five communities doesn't seem like that much money.
One thing that I did not mention is that this fund for future emissions violations that U.S. Steel has, 90% of those fines will also go into this fund.
I understand that environmental groups, though, are still dissatisfied with this agreement. What are they telling you that they want to see?
So most of these groups do say that this agreement does not have enough public input on the in terms of the trust and the advisory board that's being put together, because the details of those were not available before Monday. The Breathe Project on Wednesday released a letter to the Allegheny County Health Department and to U.S. Steel asking for a 30-day public review. They have a bunch of concerns, namely how the trust is set up. They are wondering, you know, will communities with higher populations like Clairton receive more money than these communities that have lower populations? It's sort of unclear at this point how those funds will be distributed. Another thing that executive director of the Breathe Project, Matt Mihalik, said was that this agreement lacks requirements for serious upgrades to equipment.
The agreed to repairs that U.S. Steel has offered really don't solve any of the fundamental problems with the Clairton Coke Works. They're more of a Band-Aid approach. And so the agreement is not really set up to resolve the ongoing air quality issues that the Clairton Coke Works continues to bring to our communities in the Mon Valley and affecting all of our air in southwestern Pennsylvania.
In the agreement, the upgrades that U.S. Steel is supposed to make to Clairton Coke Works are a little bit in the weeds, but essentially they are required to make changes to certain coke oven batteries to improve the capture of fugitive emissions, which is the term that the EPA and other government agencies use for leaks of gases and emissions that aren't supposed to be leaked out of the plants. Another part of this agreement calls for a new taller stack at one of the batteries to increase the dispersion of pollution from the stack. And basically how that works is that the taller the stack is, the more that pollution can be spread throughout the atmosphere.
What did the Health Department and U.S. Steel say in response to these concerns brought up by environmental groups?
Sure. So U.S. Steel did not respond to a request for comment. The Health Department, after this story was published, did respond with a statement from Ron Sugar, who's the Health Department's interim director. And he basically said that they appreciate these environmental groups weighing in, but they're not going to have a public comment period. He also said, quote, "This process has been more transparent than any such settlement agreement in the past," and they would like to move forward.
Margaret, this week you reported on the latest development in the city's move to drastically cut its carbon footprint. What did the city propose?
So right now, city-owned buildings and developers that receive public money, public subsidy, have to achieve a building standard called LEED Silver. And it's a green building standard. It's supposed to encourage buildings to be more sustainable. But the city's point is that just because you achieve a LEED Silver certification, just because you pay for that process, doesn't mean that you use less energy or that you tread more lightly upon the planet. So they want city buildings to be overhauled to be net zero energy ready.
What does net zero energy ready mean?
Net zero energy ready means basically gutting a building's major mechanical systems and replacing them with renewable energy systems. And if there isn't space in a building to do that, say, you know, whatever the power generation or the grid requirements are, if there isn't room to have a renewable energy system on site, then it would be set up to draw from off-site renewable energy systems. So these are not minor fixes. This is not replacing all the bulbs in city buildings with LEDs.
The city of Pittsburgh has, what, 140 municipal buildings? Retrofitting that many buildings to be net zero energy ready in 10 years seems pretty ambitious.
It's incredibly ambitious because they only have 10 years to meet these climate action goals, and there's not a ton of money in the budget for these retrofits. In 2020, looking at a number of different building groups together, there's about $14 million, but the city spent nearly $10 million last year on utility bills, so water, steam, sewage, electricity. And their point is, if they can free up that utility money, if they can lower the utility bills, they just will then have more money to do more retrofits. So a little bit of a cascade.
They'll do one building that will free up a little bit of money that they're spending on electricity, for example, and then they can parlay that money into the next retrofit and so on.
Yes, a virtuous cycle.
So to put this in context, the city has these really ambitious climate action goals, and three of the main ones to be achieved by 2030 are to cut carbon emissions citywide by half, to cut water consumption in city buildings by half. And the city's buildings will have 100% renewable electricity.
Yes. So that's a great point, which is that 100% renewable electricity is not necessarily 100% net zero energy ready, because you're not just lighting buildings, you're powering them, you're heating them. So, is that going to be run on renewable electricity? Maybe. If it's not, then you still have a ways to go.
And so does this have anything to do with the city's goal of cutting citywide carbon emissions in half? And to be clear for the listeners, we're talking about private property. We're talking about your home, your car. We're talking private businesses apply to this. Does this proposal speak to that at all?
No. So this measure would only affect city-owned buildings.
Do you get the sense that that's coming? Beefed up requirements for private buildings?
Originally, this legislation included language for private buildings that got public money, but it's been tabled for now because the city says first they wanted to get their own house in order and then show that they can do it and ask more of others at that point.
It's time for a quick break, and when we get back, in other news.
What's the history of the saying that Pittsburghers don't cross bridges? And how did the city contribute to the Civil War? I'm Katie Blackley from WESA's Good Question series. Join me and a panel of experts for a live discussion on these curiosities February 19th at the City Theater on the South Side. The program begins at 7:30. Tickets are $20 for adults, $10 for students and kids. That's Good Question Live, February 19th at the City Theater on the South Side. Reserve your spot today at WESA.fm.
This is Pittsburgh Explainer. I'm Liz Reed. It's time for our segment called In Other News, where we recommend a story you should check out this week. Anli, what you got?
The New York Times did a deep dive recently into risk assessment tools, and these tools essentially are software that are in wide use today, and they help government agencies and businesses make decisions in a whole range of contexts. Probably the most common example that comes to mind is the use of risk assessment in bail decision making. So when someone is arrested, a judge at the earliest stages of that person's proceedings will decide whether to hold them on bail, whether to release them. And this software, which again, it's based on an algorithm, will help to guide that decision making. It's supposed to help make more systematic recommendations to reduce any bias or discrimination in this decision making that humans may cause unwittingly. Yet there's concern that this data itself is biased.
I was going to say, Kathleen's done plenty of tech reporting that shows that algorithms are made by humans. Algorithms are not free of bias, right?
Right. Exactly. And the data itself isn't completely neutral when you think about the different variables that we rely on. For instance, if you were to draw on someone's zip code or even gender, those could be problematic things. Zip code in particular could be viewed as a proxy for race, depending on the neighborhood where you reside. So it's an issue that has far-reaching implications.
Margaret, what are you following this week?
I clicked on a story just purely by chance on CityLab entitled "Japan's Lost and Found System is Insanely Good." And it immediately struck me because I have in my life lost many things.
I left my water bottle at the yoga studio last week.
And I'm admitting now that I also have found some things that I did not attempt to return. And in Japan, there's not only a really effective system for where you turn things in, how long those things are held, once they go from there to the next place, who do you then contact? But there's also centuries of law that say that those who find lost items have to return them or take it to the police or to another authority. And then for those who find things, the law contains provisions for a reward for a certain percentage of the item's value.
Kathleen, what have you got?
So this article came out earlier this week in the New York Times by Taylor Lawrence called "Michael Bloomberg's Campaign Suddenly Drops Memes Everywhere." So over the past week, I'm an Instagram user. And if you're not on Instagram, you might not be aware that there are these meme pages that are extremely popular. So they have like hundreds of thousands.
Or you might be on Instagram, but you're just too old to know this.
So some of these meme accounts have like 100,000 to like, or hundreds of thousands to millions of followers. And basically all they do is just post memes. And so dozens of meme accounts over the past week have started posting these like fake direct message conversations with Mike Bloomberg. They basically follow this formula of like supposedly Mike Bloomberg sending them a message that says, "Hey, can you post this thing or can you post something to make me look cool?" And then the meme person is like, "Well, I don't know about this," but then they'll post this conversation. And then in like the body of the post, it says "paid for by Mike Bloomberg." So it turns out that this Bloomberg campaign is working with this company called Meme 2020, which is comprised of these Instagram meme accounts that have a collective 60 million followers. So paying them and collaborating with them to make him look good.
And it has nothing to do with his platform or his policy proposals.
No.
It's just literally putting his name out there.
Right. Exactly.
And he's trying to beat Donald Trump at his own game, like really capitalizing on different media people where they're at. And here you're seeing it with a new platform, it seems.
Yeah.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Thanks to my guests, Anlie Herring.
Thanks, Liz.
Kathleen Davis.
Thanks, Liz.
And Margaret Krause.
Thanks, Liz.
Our show is produced and engineered by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. I'm your host, Liz Reed. You can find all of WESA's reporting on our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. Thanks for listening. See you next week.